Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week we turn our focus to the cautious path ahead for Australian property, and as always, there's plenty to talk about. The Australian property market potentially faces the biggest period of uncertainty in recorded history, with the usual demand drivers such as low unemployment, high immigration levels, and easy lending, all now in a state of shock interruption as the nation grapples with the coronavirus. On the supply side, dwelling commencements have slumped, rental reductions are commonplace, and the eviction moratorium is coming to an end in September. Has Australian property succumbed to the coronavirus, or are we all just overreading the tea leaves? Here to discuss his view from the coalface of property finance, we are joined by a special guest and friend of the show, Stephen Mitchell, who is the co-founder and CEO of Melbourne-based property finance company Oak Capital and specialty lender Resicom. Stephen Mitchell, welcome back to Nucleus Investment Insights.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Great to be on. And joining us, of course, today as well to help test the Australian property for the coronavirus, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
G'day. Okay, and just finally, just a quick reminder before we get started to subscribe on YouTube and to click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live now, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat box at nucleuswealth.com/webinar, and we'll get to those throughout the show as well. So we'll jump into the agenda for today. So we're going to be looking at five key topics. So bad debts on the non-development side. We're looking at banks, developers, commercial and residential, and of course getting Stephen's input on all of those. And then finally wrapping up, as we always do, with our how we integrate these sort of themes into the portfolios we run every day here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So to kick us off, we'll jump into bad debts. Damien, I might I'll hand over to you.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I thought this would probably be the sort of start at this place, Stephen. Obviously, there's been a sort of moratorium, and we've seen banks extending interest payment holidays. I suppose people are still racking up the interest. And one of the things we're sort of quite focused on is this whole idea that yes, it's, you know, there's an idea behind some very short-term measures that might help the economy in terms of not evicting people after a couple of weeks or a couple of months of unpayment of rent, but once it starts extending out to sort of 6 months or a year, and you start really starting to add up some big numbers, it starts to become an issue for the lenders. And I just wanted to get your feel on what you're seeing in that area, and whether there's bad debts are they going to hit us at the moment? Are they going to hit us soon, or what are you seeing?
Sure, thanks, Damien. So look, I think it's an interesting area to focus on, and everyone's got slightly different views of this. Obviously, the optimist would suggest that all these measures the banks and the government are putting in are going to work out well for us all at some point. Look, I think the cautious view is they are kicking the proverbial can further and further down the road, and where is the end of it? So we know that the banks are going to continually push out the hardship claims at least till probably March next year. Having said that, we feel they're going to start being a little bit more selective on the ones that they're going to allow to extend. In the deferred payments, so the banks have referred something around 270 billion of loans have been deferred. In the sort of second tier private space that we specialize in, we understand that most of the second tier lenders are reporting anywhere from 10 to 20 odd percent, if not more, of their loan books have requested deferred payments, which is a substantial amount of loans that are on deferred payments. Mm-hmm. Of that, there is the understanding that a fair chunk of those deferred are people that are just taking the payment holiday per se, because they can. It's not that they actually need it. So logic would suggest they probably wouldn't be granted any further extensions, and they should be able to come back on board. There's another third that would potentially have some problems but will get by. and a third that are in real trouble, which still equates to quite a lot of loans across the whole book. So it's going to be interesting to see how the banks especially and the second tiers manage that into next year. But I don't think we're going to see any outcome from that this year. I think everyone's going to continually move and work with the borrowers as much as they need to into 2021. But after March 2021, they're going to start demanding some payments, and we're going to start seeing people have to move and sell their assets to get out of their loans. And I think that is where the rubber's going to hit the road. And everyone's going to be watching quite closely to see what happens with that. We internally had quite a pickup of people applying or at least considering deferring payments. The main difference with us not being an ADI, we weren't obligated to grant those payments. And I think some borrowers generally had the idea that it was a given, a six-month holiday as such. It was only when we explained that that's not a requirement, and we wanted to work with our borrowers and said, look, you need to prove to us, to show us that you have had some hardship, and in which case we'll consider working with you. And in a lot of the cases, the borrower just went, oh, don't worry about it, and they can pay. they would have a crack at having this repayment holiday, which, of course, will blow out their loan term. So, look, it's going to be very interesting, but I don't think we're going to see anything yet. I think 2021 is going to be a very, very interesting year.
Yes. And so not a lot of forced selling then at the moment?
No, not yet. And if you speak to, and we deal a lot with insolvency firms, firms Australia-wide are very, very, very quiet. So short of the odd one you see on the news where the large retailer has gone bump, the general insolvency around a business type transaction, a commercial property, a client that's got a spate of resi assets or any other sort of business, generally they are not going into insolvency at this point. With the insolvent trading laws essentially being put on hold, people just aren't having to go under. And that's where we've all seen the news about these zombie businesses, and we would totally agree. There's a lot of businesses out there that are purely limping by on the incentives that the government's flooding into the market. We're going to obviously see a fair bit of that hit again next year when they stop, when landlords are no longer going to continue to wait, and the government incentives are wound back more and more and more. The reality is going to be that unless their business has managed to pick up dramatically, which all is going to come down to these restrictions heavily, they're not going to make it. And then we're going to see the fallout effect of that, which will be extra properties on the market. And obviously extra properties will be an issue. So for sales, no, not at this point. It's very, very eerily quiet.
And so in terms of the so you spoke a little bit about the banks, I guess the mixture between the banks and the sort of second tier lenders. Do you think the you think the second tier lenders are I guess what I'm trying to come to from this is, I guess what I've heard is that the banks are going to be a lot more willing to roll things over than some of the second tier lenders that are going to be a bit faster to actually say to people, no, look, tap them on the shoulder and say, no, look, time's up, you got to sell this property because we may not be calling you in for sending you bankrupt or anything, but we're telling you in no uncertain terms, now's the time to start selling before the rush.
Yeah, I think again the banks have got obviously enormous balance sheets, and the way they're funded is very different to a second tier. The banks can ultimately decide to continually hold on for some time on these debts, but second tiers don't really have that ability. They ultimately still have liability on their balance sheets that they need to pay, so they cannot keep dragging things on because it's costing them a lot of money. They will approach this with a piecemeal approach. No one's going to want to throw a whole heap of assets obviously on the market, but even in second tier world, if the banks weren't doing it, the second tier still only fund X amount of debt, so they're not likely to cause any sort of flood of properties on the market where the banks ultimately could, but they will not be as tolerant moving forward. In most cases, they've only granted 3 or 4 month hiatus on payments, or in other cases like private lenders, have generally done sort of half month repayments or 1 month off here, et cetera. They're not doing straight out 6 month holds. And they are already working through those loan books and starting to tap them on the shoulder and saying, if you can pay, you better start paying, which will get us down hopefully to a point where the only ones left in it are the real, the genuine punters that have got real hardship claims. And therefore, lenders will try and work with them, obviously, to a much greater capacity. As I said, we still feel a fair amount of people on the hardship claims don't need to be right now. But a lot of this is also going to match into when these incentives stop running. There's a lot of businesses out there that arguably are only turning over because of the incentives. And those that money is coming through and helping them, you know, kick over their mortgage payment. So if that all comes to an end and things aren't bubbling along again in the economy, then we're going to see some more problems. But generally, the sectors cannot hold out and cannot work with people as well as the banks can on a greater scale.
Mm. And is there a it would seem to me, though, there's this is predicated on the house market not falling very much. I guess if the housing market was down, say, 20% already by now, my guess is that a lot of these guys would be scrambling a lot faster to say, well, you know, you've gone from an 80% LVR to a 0% LVR. I would prefer to get you out now before it turns into a negative one.
There's a lot of how you look in the market. If you're moving all these clients during COVID, obviously COVID is the thing and the news at the moment on everyone's lips, and you can't be seen to be moving on the clients. And also, look, in Victoria, actually it's near impossible to move on a client because the sheriff's not even operating. So you can't move if you wanted to. So it's such a bizarre market to deal with at the moment. It's unheard of.
Yeah, but it sounds, I guess, that actually adds more to, I guess, to my view that it's a bit of a binary outcome, isn't it? It's basically going, if you start seeing some people move let me put it another way. If you saw a big tick down in house prices, then a bunch of second tier lenders are going to go, look, you know what, stuff it. I just need to stuff my reputation. I actually just really need to get these people out, because otherwise I won't be around. If it falls another 5-10%, and then once they do, that gives cover for everyone else to start piling in. You know what I mean? You sort of end up in a position where you either make it through without that forced selling, or everyone piles on all at once.
Obviously is a risk. And probably not so much the second tiers, but your smaller privates would be in that group. I don't think your large second tier players would move in the same way. I think they would still try and be far more patient on the way they act on the loans in general. And remember, they're also funded by banks and other wholesale lines, and they'll have to be very cautious on what they do. But yes, micro lenders, small privates, solicitor funds, different groups will move on clients. And some of them are trying to, but the reality is the time to get possession still is extremely long at the moment. So you're better off trying to do a deal with a client in many ways and wait it out. But if there is a rush to property and a rush to sell, then yes, I think we'll find that others will jump on that, and that could cause the domino type effect.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
You either avoid the panic and it doesn't end up being that bad, or the panic starts and then it gets really bad. Yeah, and so there's probably not a lot in between. So in terms of developers, then, so what's happening there? I'm assuming there's not a lot of new projects coming on.
Yeah, so look, I think development funding itself hasn't been a massive play for our business for quite a long time. Mainly we've always seen a larger element of risk with development, but we are around the edges of it. The inquiry level for it has definitely subsided. I think you've got your very, very good, strong, well-balanced sheet backed developers. They're still getting funding. They are still getting funding through the major banks. Some of your very large second-tier lenders are still keen to do development, but they're being extremely cautious LVRs have dropped, pre-sale requirements have increased, and they're wanting very, very solid assets. So those good deals will still get away. It's your middle tier stuff now that is struggling to find a home. And I think last time we spoke about the price pressure on some of these developers when they don't fit that second tier space. That's even going to be worse now because the second tier capacity is lowered. They're not as desired to be funding all these large development deals. And that anyone beyond that is going to charge a large premium to get the money into a development deal. So that middle quality suburban builder type developer is going to struggle to get a project away. I think the bigger risk is the ones that are already coming out of the ground. These lockdowns will have untold effect on them. Like, I know it's only 6 weeks, if you believe it's only going to be 6 weeks. But that effect alone will eat up margin. And so many of these projects in the last couple of years have been done on very, very slim margins. You don't need much to go wrong. We're already hearing some development sites were having issues just getting supplies back on lockdown one due to a lot of it coming out of China. So if you had a development going this year, had a whole array of things potentially hit you, which if you're only running on a 10 or 15% margin, there's not a lot going to be left. We've seen a couple of large clients come into our office from a consultancy point of view that are ultimately putting their hands in their air and falling over. We're talking $70 million worth of developments, $10 million worth of development, a $16 million site, and a lot of lenders on that are going to take some haircuts.
What sort of projects were they, Stephen? Are they sort of your bulk, you know, low-end investment grade, or were they
some sort of five-level apartment-type complexes, groups of townhouses. One guy just ultimately had about six projects all going at once. And, of course, you have one problem with one, it rolls over into all of them. you know, the money flow has slowed down for him and it causes a trigger and they can't do anything about it. And the lenders in there right now are not capable or not that desired to advance further funds. Everyone's quite concerned. So these guys will ultimately just tip over and hand the project back to the lender and good luck. But they're halfway out, which, of course, is a major problem. And if you've got a lot of developers as well have other businesses, and if that other business is what funds the development and that's now got problems, it all feeds in. You've also got the settlement risk. You know, you've had these buyers that are not going to want to be completing and just general borrowers that cannot complete as they've had job issues and a whole range of things. So we think it's a fairly concerning market, to be honest. Especially if it's in a city is a major concern. I think some of the suburban stuff, good quality assets as always, will fare a lot better and strong developers will get them done. But the city is always, and especially now, is a major area of concern.
And I guess the other one we've spoken about a few times on this program is sort of this idea that the bad actors will pull the good act. If you let the bad actors hang around for long enough, because they can't go broke because of all these protections from insolvency and things like that, that they actually start pulling down the good actors. And sometimes the good actors will actually go broke first because, you know, they're still waiting on the bad actor to pay them. Great. And eventually they go, well, I'm insolvent and I could theoretically hold on, but actually, no, I'm not going to. I'm going to do the right thing and pull the pin now. I guess, is that affecting that developer sector or are you seeing any signs, I suppose, of that in terms of cash flow?
Look, I think at the moment we haven't really seen it because remembering that the construction space was able to continue in Victoria until lockdown 2.0, we haven't seen that side of it on that cash flow moving through to the actual development companies. I think it's more affecting if they've got other large trading companies that have been affected and that therefore affects the development themselves.
Right.
But the insolvent trading part will be a massive issue for a lot of tradies coming up, right? Because you've got these businesses that are trading insolvently. They're using tradies. They're using other businesses. And they're essentially living off their incentives to keep moving, but they're going to bring down all the businesses around them that they're using up. They're not going to be able to pay them and they know it, but they're just going to continue to drag it out and they can't get prosecuted for it. So it's going to have an effect I just cannot see how that's not. And look, as I said before, the biggest concern for us is when insolvency firms are all dead quiet, literally cannot get a job in a market like this.
Driving Uber.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So they're all hanging out. They're going to have a boom time the next few years, but it's very concerning.
That might be an area of interest for the portfolios, Damien.
yeah, that's right. There's a that's certainly one thing we're trying to look at very closely is just which sectors are the ones that of stocks that we own, are the ones that are exposed to this. People not paying and how they get hit. And as you said, I think sounds right to me is that, the tradies are usually the ones that suffer in this area, but that means, where does that blow back on eventually? Some of the other, I guess the building sectors, it's probably the little guy who suffers the most, but isn't that that's going to cop it in these?
It's the avalanche effect as well, though. Sorry. I'd imagine. It's the avalanche effect as well, where small guys that are, got the thin asset base, and then that sort of tumbles into the next one, off it goes.
Mm. And so, I think we have seen also, obviously, the government-backed and the large companies are paying their bills for the first time ever on, 7-day terms. Now, that's all well and good because they're all doing that to help out, but that won't continue. You've got BHP and Rio and all these guys paying all the businesses they trade with on very fast terms. But at some point, that'll go back to standard and these businesses will then have a cash flow issue to catch up, no different to the hospitality industry. Obviously, that's been absolutely decimated. But when they come back on board, the businesses that supply them are going to want to be paid straight away. They're not going to want to wait 60 days for payments. And that's going to create a cash flow issue for that coffee shop trying to get back in trading. So I think there's just so many little false economies that are sitting around, and it's okay to get back on board, but if you don't have any cash to get moving and pay your suppliers day one, it's going to be a very, very hard slog.
Just on that, Stephen, in your experience, and obviously, as part of your book and part of the world, what sort of do you see? What percentage of the market would you see sort of angled towards areas that are obviously going to be clearly at risk at the moment, like things like immigration and students, international students and whatnot? That are, there's a fair chance it might be zero for the next 6 to 12 or 18 months. There's obviously it's a big part, and they've got to live somewhere, and that's falls into that sort of development side of things, but. Is that going to be potentially a tipping point vis-a-vis property prices, do you think, going forward? Like, has it been so overbuilt out now that if that side of the market, gets suspended for 18 months, that could be the tipping point for everything else?
It's a crystal ball issue, isn't it? I think the student side of it, will definitely affect, especially that CBD apartment type asset. I don't feel that's going to have a massive effect on your good suburban suburbs and your urban sprawl assets, but the CBD alone, you can already see how cheap the rentals are dropping, the vacancy rates are going through the roof. So without those people there to fill those apartments, you're going to have issues, obviously, on their pricing. And also no tourists coming in, no Airbnbs being used. It's going to have an effect on all that. I think the reality is, though, of property prices around, I still think the government are going to throw a lot more incentives at this when things start to turn. They're going to want to get first-time buyers back in, and they're going to give incentives on investors to buy assets. So how far will it drop, and when will it drop? It really makes it's a very tough question. The government's going to want to keep the Australian dream alive, and that's always what they do. But there's only so much you can continually throw at it. I think tourism obviously is a major issue. You hear of some regional tourist areas that when lockdown eased, and even in WA now, Margaret River and certain areas are doing very, very well because the locals leave the city and they go out there. But the problem is that no one's coming back into the town. No one's coming back into the city. So I think anything on the inner cities and areas are going to be heavily affected. So if anything hospitality, tourism around city areas is a major, major problem, because even if we can only travel domestically for some time, which it's looking like, people will leave, the mass amount of population will leave the inner areas and go to the outer and go to regional. So I think those businesses will probably start to bounce okay at some point. But in town, who's coming to stay at the hotels? No one, which means there's nothing going to the restaurants.
Probably not Ridges anyway.
I mean, do you have a feel, you spoke about WA there, do you have a feel for, you know, I guess, the non-virus markets like Western Australia and South Australia as to how they're, you know, in terms of property markets there, are they seeing more normal situation? And I guess, is it sort of, I don't know, is it down 5% on normal or 10% on normal? Do you have a feel for?
Yeah. So look, so far, valuation reporting on, to be fair, most states, even including Victoria on some assets, hasn't moved much yet. South Australia and Perth are actually fairly even to what they have been. Perth would be somewhere, obviously, that's taken a fair hit over the last 10 years. It doesn't seem to be dropping any further. If anything, it's just mellowing out. We've spoken to a couple of accountants over there last week, and they're suggesting it's essentially business as usual, except for foot traffic is about 20% down from the normal peak. But people are going about life as normal. People are buying assets. People are, you know, it's not that hard to sell a normal property in and around Perth. So the property seems to be all right in WA. SA, we haven't had much of a, haven't had anyone over there. I've spoken to in the last little bit. But from assets we've looked at, they're valuing up as expected. There's no really cooling in the values there at all. But look, Perth's an interesting one because they're essentially going back to everyone shaking hands and doing everything over there, apparently.
Going to the football.
So and their regional centres are doing well for tourism. Anything up in Broome, anything in Margaret River, they're apparently relatively busy. It's just the problem is everyone leaves town, so there's nothing left in town. But so far, property's sitting okay in those states.
And development-wise, do you think developers in those are facing similar issues or not then?
They'll be facing the same funding issues because the funding issues essentially are Australia-wide. It's everyone has their – if they make adjustments on what they lend, they generally make that as a product, not so much based on location. So they still have the same funding issues. Whether they're having the same ability to complete, I don't think they're having that because they haven't been affected that much by as much by the virus in those smaller markets. And Melbourne has gone through a massive growth in apartments in the city more than anywhere else. Perth hasn't as much. Obviously, it's been quite quiet for some time and things have only ever been bubbling along a little bit. So I think in reality, they're not seeing the same issues that we are. You know, in Victoria, most of our inquiries to incomplete developments have been Melbourne. We've had a couple out of Sydney, but we've had a lot out of Melbourne of recent times. I saw three the other day in the same suburb, which are all, you know, 2-3 townhouse blocks where they're at stage or lock-up and they've run out of money.
What suburb?
Pardon?
Out of interest. What suburb?
Suburbs, eastern suburbs. And they've all sort of ran out of capital. So they're 200 grand, 250 grand short to finish off. So they're not bad loans from a perspective of getting in and out because they can be finished off quite quickly. But they've had cost overruns and the bank ultimately isn't supporting. So they need to start putting the money in. And we're going to see more and more of that because the actual headline builder or the headline developer who has a job doing something else that's had a downturn all of a sudden puts the eyes of the bank look across their whole portfolio and start to have problems. So that's what we're going to definitely be seeing a bit of.
So commercial, I don't know how much you have to do in commercial, but I think maybe last time we spoke, or maybe actually no, that was probably somebody else we spoke a lot about. They're saying that the strip shops in particular was a bit of a disaster zone. I'm not sure. Do you have much to do with any of the retail stuff?
Generally, retail hasn't been our flavour. If we lend on retail, we're quite conservative. As of right now, retail is on no one's. If you want to get a loan on a retail shop, I really feel sorry for you. Very, very, very difficult. Obviously, your major strips around town, we all know that they are hemorrhaging. You know, I had a meeting with an owner of a coffee shop in around De Grave Street in the city, and they're suggesting that the reopening rates are going to be extremely hammered. There's a lot of coffee shop owners just in De Graves that have put their hand up saying, we don't think we'll make it through to Christmas.
Wow.
Right? Yep. You'll see every second shop is going to have a major problem. And if the landlords don't budge, and the landlords are only been budging because the banks allowed them to. So, again, that flow-on effect is going to be an issue. We're going to see some major problems there, and then who's going to want to lease them?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting point, isn't it, that you say that yeah, when your tenant shows up and says, I'm not paying my rent, as you go, oh, okay, that's fine. I mean, you can accrue it and I'll just won't pay the bank. But at some stage, you know, you're both racking up quite big debts. And if I've got $50,000 worth of unpaid rent from a coffee shop, he hasn't got $50,000 worth of assets in there. I can flog his tables on eBay for a couple hundred bucks and that's about it.
If you have to, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Look, I think most of them are working with them quite well. We saw one coffee shop owner in town was doing a deal based on revenue. So as their revenue increased, the rent would increase. Probably quite a creative way to do it. So some of the landlords are working with them, but it depends on the landlord's personal situation. If they're well asset-backed and they don't have a lot of debt, then they can work with people more. But if you're the average Joe landlord that owns one or two commercial properties and you've got major debts on those commercial properties,
negative gearing.
So you need them to pay. So I think strip shops are a concern for valuing and also for lending on. I think most valuers now are essentially putting a COVID-19 disclaimer on everything and basically saying we have no idea what's going to go on. Here's our best bet and proceed with caution because who knows. What's going to occur. CBD office space is a killer.
I was just going to ask about that. Yep.
Yeah. Go on. our contacts at JLL and CBRE suggesting that next year is high time for if you want to lease something in the city because you're going to get outrageous
deals. Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're referring it to Perth about 5 years ago. So where you'd be able to get, I know one large firm that got an office in Perth on a 7-year lease, and they had 3.5 years free.
Well.
So if you can get lease deals like that in the city, as great as that is for the person going for the lease, it's terrible for obviously the underlying landlord and the value of those towers. So it's going to take such a long time for return to work to occur. You know, we're very big on it internally. All of our staff want to be back in town working. But even if you have 20%, 30% of the CBD not come back, that effect is enormous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And are going to look at better ways to curb costs. So
yeah.
CBD is the most concerning location, I would suggest.
We're in a WeWork, and so and I was initially thinking, are they going to? They're actually going to be the hardest hit by all this. And I'm actually wondering now whether though some of these shared office might actually find that I'm not saying they're going to do well out of this, but they might not do as badly as I thought in terms of people who now to start going, you know what, I've got a 10-person office, but everyone's going to work from home half the time. So why don't I just take out a 5-person office at WeWork and at least then as well, I'm not exposed to like a, you know, do I want to take out a 7-year lease right now, or do I want to just maybe, you know, pull my head back in and I'll go month to month at WeWork for a bit, and you know, if the whole thing blows over, then I can go back to a bigger office. I don't know whether you're.
I think that's very true. I've seen some reports about that. I think these are some of the areas that will obviously change and become quite dynamic. And I think that short term ability to lease smaller spaces, flexible spaces, will be huge because you do get a lot of people that want to work from home but also want to be able to go in for meetings, want to have 2 days in if their kids are home and need that space. And I would agree that a lot of firms, even small 10-person firms, would say, you know what, guys, work from home and every, you know, we'll have 5 of you in on these days and we'll just work from this office, a shared space, saves costs, nothing to maintain in and out. And if you are unsure of the next few years, you're also not locked in. So I think that's a massive area that will actually go quite well. Another interesting view I had off of Value the other day was regarding holiday homes, proper holiday homes where people, you know, in decent areas actually will hold up quite well, as they feel there's probably more pressure on the inner city areas as people will decide they can move for a sea change.
Further out, that's right.
And, you know, they'll move out to the peninsula now because, you know what, I only need to come in one day a week. I can work from home, so it doesn't really matter where I am. So some of those more regional and holiday locations actually will potentially be quite strong. And the idea...
Providing the internet's all right, as long as they've got NBN.
What's that?
As long as they've got NBN.
Yeah, right, as long as they've got the good internet. And even the idea of having a holiday home has apparently increased, given people going, I'm not going to be traveling overseas for so long. I want to have a holiday home. If they got money to do it, then so be it. So it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. And I wonder, though, because it's an interesting thought. I was thinking more of the regional ones in terms of going, well, if people want to get, you know, an hour out of Sydney or an hour out of Melbourne or Brisbane or whatever and into more sort of, I guess, country areas, is that, well, there is stacks of land and there might be a short-term push, but, you know, you can the build could easily bring the costs back down again if you start doing more development out there. But I suppose you're right in that most sort of beachside type suburbs are already got a fair few restrictions on what you can build and what you can't build, haven't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Got a question here from a listener. So we've got, how do you perceive, just while we're on the residential theme, how do you perceive current mainstream media reporting on real estate values and the first home buyer program? So I might, and there's a second part to it, but any views on the way that the real estate values are being reported at the moment? It seems to be, obviously it's been fairly quiet in the industry, so there's probably not a lot to report on. But
yeah, so look, I think... you know, you see the spruiking side of it, which would suggest the clearance rates are still really good and all these things, but obviously there's not a lot on the market, right?
Mm.
The big thing everyone needs to remember is if there's not a lot on the market and someone needs to buy a house and move, then things are going to sell.
Yep.
So the catch is going to be when they do put things on the market. So far, residentially, we as lenders haven't seen that many problems at all. To be honest, even in Sydney, we've had some sales of recent and they've sold well and they've sold over reserve. Even in Victoria, they're selling generally on point. So we haven't seen any sort of 10% drop or anything like that at all. Look, your less desirable assets are always going to be a bit harder to sell. That's the reality. Good assets, good suburbs will generally sell. I know there's a couple of high-end ones in Bayside suburbs that are selling very, very well and very quickly. I personally went and looked at one the other week out of interest and it never got listed and sold within about 3 days. That was a super high-end property. So certain things are still moving if people want them and if people want to move around. The first-home buyer market, you know, I think that's there at the moment, and for as long as people can get those incentives, that'll always bubble along, but I don't think that's going to make a massive change to the overall scheme of things. Commercial is where we've seen the biggest effect, and we've had some assets that we've looked at and that we've had to move on, and they have dropped in value. You know, what they were in 2019, they've definitely dropped. If they became vacant, tenants moved out, and they were, you know, a standard sort of commercial property that was used to host some sort of office, you know, we're now getting offers for land sites, right? They're just not looking at them as an ongoing office concern. So it's going to be very interesting where that heads. I think commercial assets and retail are a major issue already.
All right. And just the second part of that was just a view on first home buyers being able to use their super to buy a house in this market. Yeah. Throw it open to both of you, like.
Look, I'll comment. The whole idea of pulling super out and using super to buy houses, you know, it's of concern to me that people are draining super. Obviously, buying assets is generally a good thing, but once super comes out of people's super funds into their own names, I don't feel it's used in the same way. And it's not necessarily treated with the same caution and protection that it should be. And we need to be mindful of that as a country that grows, that people use up all their super now. You know, we saw that when they allowed for the 10,000 each side of ended
yeah.
be pulled out, and the majority of people spent it just on standard items. That's great for the economy, not so good for that person's future in 20 years. So, look, I don't know if people should really be pulling funds out of super fund to buy homes themselves. But it depends on their investment play and if they're genuinely going to invest it correctly.
Yeah. And just flipped in from Candy Flip. Thanks for the tip. There's just been announced actually that in Victoria anyway, that rental evictions the ban's been extended to the end of the year. So. Yes, as we were saying, it's and as you're saying, like, we haven't had an official one on the home loans yet, have we? That's still 30th of September, but given we haven't heard anything about how they're going to transition, then it sounds as if that's probably on the cards as well, as you said.
That would continue. And look, the banks are going to honour it anyway. They're just going to have to move very, very slowly. As I said, I think if they can shave off 30% of that $270 billion 30 or 40% they actually can pay and try and work with those borrowers and get them paying and reduce that number down, they'll probably be quite happy with that. And then do it again in January and do it again in March. I don't know any other way forward without causing them to default a lot of borrowers and cause some major problems.
Just on that, Stephen, so just a reflection, and you mentioned before about how obviously it's very quiet, and I guess that makes a lot of sense. Not sure if you were in the same game during the GFC or, you know, we're sort of as close to the coalface, but, you know, obviously the big difference is that the RBA had, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 bullets left in the gun to cut rates, you know, to help sort of stimulate post-GFC. Obviously that's not there now. Do you see a similarity, I guess, in what's going on outside and then obviously some views perhaps on, you know, monetary policy is not going to be able to save the day this time, is it?
Yeah, well, look, I think I was around in the GFC and it was one of my busiest times, to be honest. I feel this is very different this time around. The GFC had obviously was viewed as an economic crisis. You had lenders that didn't necessarily have a lot of experience in what they were going to do in such a crisis. I think a lot of lenders have learnt from the GFC, and that's why the banks have worked so closely with the government to put in protections immediately to not allow for that sort of run on property that occurred in the GFC. Also in the GFC, you obviously had all the run on the mortgage funds. The bank guarantee came in. But we felt at that time there wasn't obviously these moratoriums on debts or anything in the GFC. No, we were flat out because people needed money and they needed money to pay people. They needed money to pay. Still, they had to pay the tax man. They had to pay their other debts. Right now, it's like we're in the eye of the storm. We've seen all this stuff happening and initially there's all this panic and now it's just very quiet, cruisy. What's going on? People aren't even needing to borrow capital. You know, on a very low level, we're just not seeing those applications come through. We're not seeing people needing to pay the tax office because the tax office isn't going to force you to pay right now. They're not needing to pay their landlord because it's on hold. They're not needing to pay their mortgage. So everything's very, very quiet, but at some point that the other side of the storm will come and, you know, hopefully it comes in a controlled way and things can be managed through to the best outcome of the whole economy and the property market. But it has to come and the pressure will come on those borrowers at that time. The GFC was, you know, it was sort of all hit straight away, I felt, and it continued in that way, whereas this started and then it sort of stopped and it's gone quiet and we're going to see the other side.
And the thing is we've had the preemptive stuff, you know, because when you do get, we would argue that the property market, and I think you obviously agreed last time we were on, is the property market was pretty fully valued in Australia, and you know, there were people out there who were overgeared and overleveraged, when you get a downturn and you wash out some of those, it's actually quite healthy for the overall market. You just want to make sure that the average people aren't also going broke. Whereas it seems as if this time we've been preemptive. It's like, right, let's make sure nobody goes broke. And so the problems are still there. As you said, they haven't gone away. We're actually just sitting on – we're actually seeing those problems just get bigger and bigger. And so
they're going to have to be very, very cautious how they're approached next year, work through those issues. Look, the saving grace for a lot of people and still is such a low interest rate environment. Obviously, in the GFC, we had that ability to pull the trigger and reduce rates, whereas now there's nothing left.
Fix bayonets.
The only way to do it is to stimulate and put money physically into the economy, which they will do and they will continue to do. But look, it's going to be very interesting to see how they work their way through it next year. I still think if we can have a decent return to the economy and businesses can jump back in, then hopefully it's a smaller amount of businesses that will not be able to make it than the greater, obviously.
Hmm. Yeah.
A lot of it depends on lockdowns and how long they continue.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and there's this whole part about, as I said, we've had 6 months now, and we've known for 6 months that, well, four and a half months. We're just coming up on the fifth month of having these moratoriums. So there's been a fair bit of time to plan. I haven't actually seen any plans about how we're going to get out of this, which is why I'm going, yeah, everything's just going to get extended again. Mm-hmm. Have you seen anything? Is there any sort of plan from what you've seen about how announcements in
– all the financial services companies have all got their views and their graphs, which suggest ways out of it. But ultimately, every business person you speak to has the same frustration in general about this situation, that – does not appear to be a plan at all regarding A, with just purely the virus, let alone, you know, with lockdowns and at what number do you release this and when are we actually going to learn to live with this as opposed to just lockdown? What happens if the vaccine is not for another 12 months? And then what's going to happen economically and with the financial requirements people have? But I think the financial part's going to come secondary to what the government's going to put out. If the government's going to continue to extend, then the banks are going to continue to extend because the alternative is not great either. They're well backed. They've got big, large balance sheets. They can continually hold for quite some time. But it's a very, very tricky situation. And to be fair, I don't even think the government know what they want to do. Everyone's living by the edge of their seats at the moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sort of, you know, options are falling away, like you mentioned before, with the $10,000 withdrawals from super, you know, over the straddling the financial year. And, you know, I think I saw a stat the other day. So obviously $30-odd billion has come out of superannuation, which is basically, you know, an off balance sheet for the government payment, stimulus payment. It's come out of the personal pocket, not their own. But of course, now you've got 550,000 accounts that have been drained. If you just go, oh yeah, we'll let them have it again next year, they can't. Those 550,000 people have got nothing left. So
yeah, correct.
You know, that's not going to work.
We don't have a lot in super, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that lever's been pulled.
It's going to become an issue for the future. That's for sure.
Before we get off these commercial ones, so. You touched on it a little bit, but we've heard a bit about the whole residential conversions of office and all that type of stuff. That all seems just a bit hypothetical at the moment. Is any of that actually, or have you seen anything actually going on in terms of that space?
As in residential converting?
Yes, as in office converting to residential.
Oh, look, so I think we've – a lot of obviously the major players are referring – that they're going to be having, work from home forever or for a very, very long time.
Yep.
I know the majors essentially a couple of months back, interestingly enough, when we started to go back to the office and venture back optimistically, all the BDMs that work for the major banks were all saying that they've been told you're not coming back at least till January. And we all went, oh, surely not, that's ridiculous. But, hey, they're probably right. I know that one of the large banking institutions just took out a whole building at around the top end of Collins Street, and that was all done for hot desking types. And they're now looking at that going, well, what are we going to do? Because they've done this whole fit out, and that's not going to work in a COVID-type environment. and talking to their staff, they're just getting ready to work from home potentially for their career. Like these guys, it seems to work for apparently for these larger firms. I think smaller groups, it just does not work for. You know, we need to like to workshop with our staff and sit around over a coffee and come up with ideas and do things like that. I struggle to sit on Zoom for 8 hours a day. But a lot of the large firms are going to do it. We know NAB are going to have mothballed their whole Docklands setup, which was relatively new. It's going to have a major effect. And if you think about Docklands already, which has been an area that's struggled to ever get traction since day dot, and now you're going to lose the majority of your major tenants, at least to a large proportion for the next couple of years, you wouldn't want to have a business in Docklands. There's not going to be anyone around. There's not anyone around on the best of days. it was only starting to bubble of recent. But if you've got the restaurant down there and you're reliant on a lot of bankers and that come into your restaurant every day, it's really, really sad. But all the big groups are suggesting it's going to be from home for a long time, and they'll permanently make that a mark for a lot of their staff.
Yeah, and so I guess what I'm saying, so you can sort of see some of those where they'll just go, okay, we had an office building there, let's just convert the whole thing into residential, and that will create more problems for the in terms of supply for the market.
Oh yeah, look, sorry, converting actual office spaces to residential spaces is not something I've seen as yet.
Yeah,
I haven't really seen or read much about that at all. I think that's probably too early at this point. I think they're going to wait and see what's really going to occur. And, you know, yeah. I think lockdown one, we had a lot of people suggesting they love working from home. Lockdown two, a lot of people saying they can't stand it. So I think let's just see how it all washes out. There's definitely going to be a large element of it. I'm just not sure if it's going to be as strong as people suggest a couple of years from now.
In the reporting season so far, the industrial guys have held up a fair bit better. Is that... Do you have anything to do with industrial?
Industrial from a property perspective, yes. Industrial assets have been okay. Industrial in any sort of, factory warehousing sort of situation has been okay because those businesses are still trading. So those underlying assets therefore hold up on value. It's really your commercial and office, sorry, your retail and office type properties that are heavily, heavily affected. Industrial production type locations are still trading because that part of the market's doing all right. We haven't seen any major issues with property prices on those sorts of assets.
Yep. Yes. Now, one of the final things, given we're almost up to the hour, but one of the final things I wanted to try and run off, and we touched on it earlier, is this I guess choices people make between switching, say, going, okay, well, I might have been happy in an apartment before, but now if it's a prospect that I'm going to be working from home 4 or 5 days a week, or the kids are going to be locked out of their schools for a bit, maybe I'm better off with a house, or people moving from cities to regional areas. Just want to sort of get your is that a trend, I guess, in terms of the way you're looking at lending? You spoke already about inner city is not good. I guess have you got a sort of houses versus apartments preference as well?
Yeah, I think we have that view on inner city apartments, inner suburban apartments, and large tower complexes are definitely less favourable. You know, I saw a loan scenario last night for. I didn't even know it was going up, to be honest. There's so many towers going up in Melbourne. There was two large, circa 60-storey towers that are going up and got inquired for a bundle of apartment loans to overseas investors. And, you know, obviously it's quite concerning that some investors have bought X amount in these buildings, and the whole building effectively may have been sold out to overseas, which is going to have major problems. And who's going to rent these things? Mm. Major, major issue. So... We quoted on that, but at a very, very low LVR and only for a couple of them. So, look, standard resi homes, normal suburban Melbourne, even some of the decent regional areas, we'll land on something in Ballarat or Bendigo or Geelong. you know, they're all good, decent markets in their own right. I'd much prefer to be lending on something with land. Having said that, there is a lot of pull these days for high quality apartments as well. Seen some of the stuff that Gurner's done has sold really, really well for locals because they're larger apartment type buildings where people, you know, professionals with a couple of kids want to live in an apartment, but they're generally not in the city. They're in the burbs. So that stuff's okay. And look, in discussions with estate agents, a lot of houses that have got that extra space, that study, that separate room, the downstairs area, have apparently been quite hot because people are considering now working from home is going to become somewhat semi-permanent and an option for them. So if you've got a bit of money, you've still got your job, then you can look around and get a bigger property to live from and have your work from home from there. So I definitely, there is a push outward of the city centre that's going to be there for some time.
Yeah, because as Tim was saying, you know, you don't want to commute an hour and a half a day, but you know, if you only got to do it one day a week, then maybe that's worth it. If it was a zero hour commute on 4 days and a 1.5 hour commute one day a week might seem better than a 30 minute every day.
Yeah. Well, from what I've heard, that's what's been happening in Geelong as well. Actually, just sort of anecdotally, there's been a big surge in people, you know, or been interest down in Geelong. Maybe it's just because they can have auctions down there and we can't. I don't know. 5K rule and all the rest. But anyway, very good. We'll jump across to the investment outlook, Damien. And I've just actually had a question here, but if you like, well, we can keep
going. Great question first, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So I've just got one here. So are there any real estate investors seeking to hedge their portfolio by shorting Aussie banks or developers? So is there any sort of, do you know of any hedging that's going on?
Sorry, from me or from Stephen?
You can throw it open to the panel.
I don't know of any hedging going, not my will.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I don't think it happens in a big sense. I guess for smaller investors, look, you'd have to take a pretty big swing at some of those to hedge. I guess the issue for most of it is, you know, you might have what's the median price in Sydney or Melbourne is sort of $1 million, and you know, most of the other cities are certainly in the high couple hundred thousands. If you really wanted to hedge yourself, you're going to take a pretty big swing at some of these mm-hmm. banks. So I'd probably lean on the case of trying to work out where else you can get exposure rather where else you can get
upside.
Yeah. Look, I can certainly see how it might work. I don't know. I guess I worry about as well, you know, hedging particularly liquid assets versus very illiquid assets as well, where you know, in the end, if you're looking at a property, you're saying I'm taking a 10-year view on this thing, or I'm living in it for my own purposes, and so yes, property prices might fall 20%, but then they might recover. You know, by the in 10 years' time, they might be back to where we started, and so you know, having that hedge on a short on an Aussie bank, does it actually do anything for you if you weren't going to do it? And then the part then is saying, well, if you're actually a developer, say, and you need to make this money to get your dollars back, then I suppose there's probably more efficient ways to hedge rather than that. So yeah, I don't know.
Fair enough.
Doesn't jump out as something I'd rush out to do, but
double risk. Yeah, sure. Do you want to just quickly run through some of the angles we've been taking with the portfolios as well, Damien, and we can say goodbye to Stephen?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, look, I think some of the stuff that comes out from today that certainly links back to some of our thoughts is this idea that nothing's been done to plan for anything, and so things are just going to get extended. So it's the issue that we haven't seen. You know, how are we going to actually get around the you know, not being able to kick people out and how are we, what's going to happen once banks actually ask people to front up and start spending some money? And given though there's no work being done around it, as we said, there saw the announcement there from Victoria's extending it to the end of the year. I think given where, you know, had a sage comment from somebody the other day, which is I'm preempting it coming on from next week, but that yeah, politicians don't want this thing to happen towards the end of the year. They're more likely to want it to happen next year. So you're going to get extended from 30 September at least 3 months and quite possibly as much as 6 months. So it does feel as if, you know, I think I'm going to steal Stephen's term there, you know, that the eye of the hurricane type view that, you know, we are in this spot where there's it's eerily quiet, and it might things seem like they're all right, and so there's sort of a sense of normality, and there's some things I think you can be doing in your portfolios at the moment that you don't have to be as fearful, but I certainly wouldn't want to be taking too many aggressive positions at the moment, and you need to acknowledge that there's a lot of problems under, you know, just waiting to come out the other side. So yeah, maintaining that protection is important. But given I think we're going to be pushing out for a little bit longer, I think that, you know, probably don't need to be as protected as you were a few months ago.
Okay. Yep. Very good. And just to you, Stephen, thanks very much for coming along and for sharing your insights on the property market and all things finance, property finance. Would you like to share with our listeners, of course, how they can follow some of your work or get in touch, or what an ideal client is for you, mate?
Yeah, sure. Look, I'll just touch on it in two parts. So obviously we're a boutique mortgage fund. So from an investor point of view, we deal with both retail and wholesale investors. We run a contributory fund. So therefore investors get to select the actual mortgage investment that they wish to invest in. Therefore, they know the asset that they're ultimately secured by. Obviously, offer attractive returns. So for more info on that, I would refer them to the oakcapital.com.au website to look at a PDS or IM. From a borrower or broker perspective, obviously, we lend to clients for business purposes, all secured against quality real estate, generally lending up to about 65% of the property value, and mainly on the east coast of Australia, but we do lend nationally. And now, you know, we look at a deal and we'll give a quick yes or no to help the clients out as they need it, and settle within 3 to 4 days as a rule. So we can provide capital quite quick for paying out a tax debt if they need funds to complete a different sort of development site, if there's other creditors, or even just for a purchase that a bank hasn't come to the party on in time and they need to settle and bridge it for 6 to 12 months. So I'm always happy to see scenarios and to consider what we may be able to do for them. So again, to the website at oakcapital.com.au. So thank you, gentlemen.
Sure. No worries at all. Yeah, thanks very much. And we'll stick those in the show notes as well. And of course, yeah, we look forward to getting you back on the show shortly, Stephen, and perhaps on the other side of the eye of the hurricane, as it were, of the cyclone.
No problems at all. Thanks. Stay safe. Right. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. So coming up next week, we've got another special guest in Professor Richard Holden. So Richard is the Professor of Economics at the University of New South Wales Australian Business School, and he joined us this week to share with us his take on the current state of the Australian economy and some crucial decisions that lie ahead for policymakers to help steady the national ship in the face of this remarkable pandemic. It was a terrific hour. He's a really smart guy. Got some great input from there. So look forward to that one. It's next Thursday, 27th of August. It is a pre-recorded, be coming out at 12:30 on the YouTube stream. So we'll look forward to that one. And of course, as always, we hope you've enjoyed today's show. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. To stay up to date on news from us, follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest or topic suggestions. So if you've got one, please drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video and we can research and bring those to you. And just finally, if you know anyone that would get something out of today's episode, share with a friend, let them know about it and help our show grow. So on that note, thanks for tuning in, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.